Good evening. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight, a conversation with Bill Littlefield, host and originator of National Public Radio's Only a Game, and, as we are about to discover, active in a good deal more. In addition to his work on Only a Game and as commentator on NPR's Morning Edition, Littlefield this year celebrated his 25th year at Curry College, where he is a professor of literature and writing in the humanities department. As well, he is the author of four books, including a series of essays called Baseball Days and the novel Prospect, recently published in paperback by Houghton Mifflin. We caught up with Bill Littlefield recently at the Barnes & Noble bookstore in Boston's Kenmore Square.
I used to do an opening day poem every year for Morning Edition. And it's not really poetry, it's doggerel. But I thought I'd read one of the opening day poems just because it's almost opening day. It was just a couple days ago. It should be sun-splashed, warm and promising, blue skies overhead. It should echo with shouts and laughter, and hope should rise like bread. There should be a seat for every child who's never been to a game, and the home team should win in each park today, no matter the home team's name. The rookie who barely made the club should go 3 for 4 with a walk. The old guy back on a surgical knee should steal third and get home on a balk. The beer should be cold and the hot dogs hot and the popcorn and peanuts free, and no one should even consider the wave or watching replays on TV. The pitcher should work without delay and the hitter should step in and hit. The umpires should be so sure on their calls that no one gives them a hard time. It won't be that way, not in every park, not in any park, I suppose. Instead, the traffic will pile up early, and in the cheap seats, the bozos will rip off their shirts, though it's 40 degrees, and scream at the players below. The reliever who cost the home team untold millions will struggle and probably blow the save, and the manager, tired already, will trudge like slow death to the mound, and the kids will be restive and angry and cold, and the pitcher will stare at the ground. The visiting team will score often and easily, turning the game to a rout. By the fourth half, the crowd will have left in disgust, their summer now riddled with doubt. We go because we don't know which it will be, and because against sense we still care. We go to be back in the presence of baseball, to witness it, because it's there. We go to renew that corn-pone continuity some of us value, and hey, we go because fading and loss notwithstanding, each year still has opening day. I sometimes read in schools, and teachers want to know what writers have influenced my work, and I always say primarily Dr. Seuss.
Let's step back for a moment, Bill, and let me ask you what it's like to do a reading from your own work to an audience that came to hear it.
Well, it's very gratifying that anybody comes to hear it, obviously. And it's fun to read from this book because it's kind of like visiting an old friend. I wrote the book quite a long time ago. It was published in 1989. And it did okay for a first novel, but like almost all first novels, went out of print fairly quickly.
The book is titled Prospect, and it begins with the scout, Pete Esty.
Right.
In what we used to call an old folks' home, not
right.
Kind of a retirement village or whatever.
Right. It's called Fair Haven in this book, and the irony is entirely intended because Pete, when we first encounter him in Prospect, has basically checked himself into this place to die. He's outgrown his usefulness to baseball. He's been a scout for years and years, but he feels he's outgrown his usefulness. All the people that he knew as a scout have retired or died. And he just wants to, sort of play out the string as quietly as he can and be no trouble to anybody. And the problem is that one of the women who works in Fairhaven is a woman named Louise Brown, and she thinks it's ridiculous that a scout should retire. She says old men, after they retire, go to baseball parks and watch games under the sun. That's what scouts do. How can you retire from that? That's what people retire to when they've been plumbers or electricians or lawyers or doctors. So she's outraged that he's giving up on his own life. And, of course, she has an ulterior motive. She has a great-nephew named Jack Brown who she thinks is a prospect. And she just feels that all he needs is somebody to see him and make the right phone call and get him on his way to the major leagues.
A couple of things. First of all, what I thought was going to be a baseball story. It is a baseball story all the way through. But it's a love story as well.
Well, I hope so. Every novel has to be set somewhere. whether it's set in politics or set in the story of a war or set in baseball, you know, you try to write the best story you can, no matter what the setting is, and you try to set it, at least I try to set what I write in worlds that I'm at least passing familiar with, and so that's why this one is set in baseball.
At the bookstore reading, you read a long passage from the book. Let's hear some of that now.
This is a passage from the first night that he spends in Louise's house. She has a guest room, and he's alone in the room. It's not a house. It's a half a house. It's an apartment, like a two-family. On my back in the strange bed, I was aware of strange sounds. A couple of doors down the street, somebody was hammering erratically in the moonlight, trying to patch his steps. Somewhere else, a woman was calling a dog named Fitzy or Fritzy, whistling between the shouts. For the first time since I'd checked into Fairhaven, I was smack dab in the center of somebody's neighborhood. The sounds of Fairhaven were those of any hotel. Water running somewhere else in the building, a muffled cough. In the hallway, the monotonous hum of nighttime television. But here in Louise's spare room, I heard the voices and chatter of men and women she probably called by their first names. During the time when Alice and I were trying to be a happy couple in the middle of the block, I heard the same sounds. We giggled in bed about the man a few doors down who came home from work at 6, set up ladders, scaffolding, and spotlights, and painted his house for an hour before dinner. He did a little perfect patch each night as long as the weather stayed warm enough. When he was finished with the house, it was time to start again. We heard the runaway dogs and cats, too, and the children clattering up and down their driveways and wagons, more children all the time. In the morning, I often woke up before the alarm. While Alice slept, I listened to the soft plop of the newspapers falling on doorsteps up and down the block. When I heard my own paper fall, it triggered some tiny, harmless sense of pride. I, too, was established enough to have a paper delivered. It would be there when I walked out to get it, the illusion of substance. Why hadn't our life turned out like those of other couples, the other families on the street? We loved each other more than most, if I was any judge at all. We had no children, and they did seem to be the glue that held much of it together for many of the others. So much to keep track of while children are growing into and out of clothes and shoes, learning to use the toilet, needing braces or glasses or discipline or love. Alice could have filled that gap by being herself in the world and a wife to me. She faced up to disappointments, took them on squarely, maybe raged against her life without whatever it lacked, but stayed planted where she was. I was the one who was always leaving to watch baseball games, just as I'd once left to play in them, wherever they told me to go. In the afternoon, Louise had spoken with such frank love about her husband. Almost the first thing she'd mentioned after his name was that they had been apart only when he'd been in the service. Lying now in her spare room, I found myself thinking what a lucky man Edward Brown must have been to be able to find such substance in another human being who loved him so well and so long with her warm arms and her heart so steady in the world. What constancy they'd made for each other and how nuts they must have thought anyone who couldn't find nurture and satisfaction as they had in each other. How they must have laughed at the folly of men who chased women, women who took many lovers, sharpies, pros, hustlers always looking for an edge. What a simple completeness they'd found in one another, and what a comic mystery that so many others were rushing and rioting around without it. I couldn't be a smart aleck about a marriage like that, you see. I couldn't dismiss it as timid. Ballplayers I'd known had joked a lot about their marriages, claiming it was only long months in spring training and on the road that allowed them to survive. My marriage had ended twice because I couldn't leave the game alone. Lying there in that spare room, I admitted to myself that Alice, twice my wife, might have spoken of a better husband, the way Louise spoke of hers. I never doubted my wife's strength and devotion, but I couldn't provide them with an object. Put simply, I couldn't sit still when baseball was going on all around me, and somebody was willing to pay me to play it or watch it, and I thought, Jesus, what a sweet and precious thing you've blown. But I knew as quickly as the thought came that it wasn't that simple. Only a child would think it was. Now it was late enough so that the hammering had long ago stopped and the dogs and cats were in or out where they belonged. Occasionally a car hissed on the road out front. The reflection of the headlights glanced off the window and found the corner of the small room. Otherwise, it was still in Louise's home. When Alice and I lived together before the traveling ruined it, or during the times we both believed I was looking for a job that would keep me home, or when I half believed it anyway, we slept curled up together. It became a habit, and even now I couldn't sleep anyway but on my right side, bent into a kind of half-circle that she would have fit into. I pulled myself into that position, and the moon coming through the window was full in my face. I remembered a superstition, an old wives' tale about how a woman who wanted to get pregnant should show her belly to the full moon. Now here I was, old beyond the promise of children, old almost to where the distinction between old man and old woman disappears, and here was the moon, more barren than any desert we know, and linked with fecundity, romance, and spooning in June. Since it didn't look like sleep was going to come, I finally fell back on the same trick I'd used at the pool in Fairhaven when I wanted to quietly occupy my mind without giving it anything really worrisome to chew on. I set it to running down the lineup of the Brooklyn Dodgers the year they finally won the World Series in 1955. Their catcher was Campanella, who was later crippled and confined to a wheelchair. Johnny Padres was their ace in that series, a boy who could have been mayor of New York when it was over. Years later, he became a mean bastard of a pitching coach. Pee Wee Reese anchored the infield at shortstop, and after he retired, people bought bumper stickers that said Pee Wee should be in the Hall, meaning the Hall of Fame, of course. Eventually, he made it, and on his plaque, it says he helped ease the way for Jackie Robinson. Robinson played third base and stole home in that series, which is sure something you don't see much of anymore. Jackie had a son who was a dope addict. He died of a stroke. Duke Snider, Carl Farrillo, and Sandy Amrose played in the outfield. Amrose made the catch off Yogi Berra that saved the series. My God, that was something. Afterward, all the writers gathered around him, and somebody asked Sandy whether he'd thought he had a chance for the ball as it started hooking away from him toward the left field foul pole. I don't know, said Amrose, shaking his head. I just run like hell. Junior Gilliam played second base, and Gil Hodges was at first. Gil Hodges could have been mayor of New York, too. Both of them are dead now. I'd gotten to the rest of the pitching staff, Carl Erskine, Clem Labine, Don Newcomb, and was just trying to remember the name of the right-handed kid they traded to Baltimore the next year when I realized that all the names I could call up were attached to Jack Brown's face, and I guess that's when I finally slept. So that's how Pete occupies his time.
There's no real villain in this book.
Well, I suppose that's true in terms of a person that you would identify as a villain. I think that there is a villainous tendency of people to age, and as they age and as their capacities become diminished, they give up on things. And so there are heroes, and I think the heroes in the book are the people who recognize that you need to get up and do every day. You have to, forget the pain and forget the despair that tends to trickle in and just get out and do.
Well, and even if you can't get out and do, even if, as one of the characters is, you are confined to Fairhaven, there are visits from imaginary daughters.
Right.
Babe Ruth slides down the flagpole. Jackie Robinson visits.
To deliver messages to Pete, yes, via somebody who has no idea who these people are. Yeah, part of this comes from my own experience. One of the most interesting things about writing this book for me, Ted, was that as I wrote it and as I was writing scenes that took place in Fairhaven, I got back the sights and the sounds and the feeling of being in places like this. Both my grandmothers were in nursing homes, so one of them for a very long time. And it came back, the sound of the nurse's rubber-soled shoes on the linoleum floor, the sound of coughing down the hall, all of that came back. And in ways that I never really thought it would, because it wasn't stuff that I was storing. It had never occurred to me 15, 20 years ago that I would ever write a book that was set in a nursing home, or that a lot of it took place in a nursing home. Mm.
The other thing that your writing did, at least for me, was that the story just sort of seemed to unfold. It just kind of happened. And it was only later that I saw the contrast between the youth and the strength and the sheer joy of playing baseball, which Jack Brown, or Jackie Brown, the great nephew, engages in, and even Pete's own memories. And I wanted to ask you, at one point, Pete Esty, the scout, who played 6 or 7 years of double-A ball.
Right, and he never got higher than double-A.
Never really rose to the top, never really fulfilled his dream, and yet understood on his last day that the act of playing was the most wonderful thing about his whole experience, and wanted to convey this to his teammates and to the opposition players as he stood on first base.
Right. And, of course, it was hopeless.
Of course, they were playing
in a baseball game. Pete had an interesting opportunity, which he doubtless did not appreciate at the time. But he was told before the game that he was going to be released. And as you say, he'd been 7 years in the minor leagues. There was no chance that he was going to be picked up anywhere else. And at the same time that he was told he was going to be released, he was offered a job. The team that he'd played for was going to train him to be a scout, and he ended up being a scout for years and years. But because he knew that this was his last game, there was an intense recognition. The lights were brighter. The grass was greener. The sounds were sharper because he knew that he would never be on the field as a player again. And so he thinks about doing crazy things. Pete is very slow. He hits the ball a long way, but he can't run much. He walks in one at bat, and he stands on first base, and he thinks he'd really like to steal second. And we'd like the third career steal, but he'd love to do it just for the joy of sliding in the dirt, you know, and getting his uniform dirty on that last day.
But what he did do was stroll off the base far enough to draw a throw from the pitcher, and then, although he didn't have to slide,
had to go back,
slid.
Just for the joy of it.
Yeah, just for the joy. Did that moment ever come for Bill Littlefield?
Oh, yeah, and I denied it for years. I played in a fast-pitch softball league over in Cambridge for about 20 years, and I had a wonderful time, and I had great experiences playing with the same guys and then with some of their sons as time went on. And then eventually, 3 or 4 years ago, I got to the point where I looked down the bench one day and I was counting, you know, 3, 4, 5 designated hitters. I thought, oh, man, that's really too many designated hitters for any team. And the other thing that told me that it was time to quit was I used to play second base sometimes when we were shorthanded. And I was out there playing second base. I was about 46 or 7, I guess. And the kid playing shortstop was 25 and a real good athlete. And he came over to me before the game started. And he said, you know, just to get all the signals straight. And he said, okay, on the left-hand batters, man on first, left-hand batter, I'll cover second for the steal. So now that's standard. That's what you do with a shortstop and the second baseman. He started back to his position. Then he turned around and he said, I'll take it for the right-hand batters, too. And I realized, you know, he knows that it's not that I've lost a step. I've lost about 3 yards, you know, getting from second base to the bag. And so eventually I recognized, as Pete Estey did, I didn't have to be released. I released myself, but probably only minutes before I would have been released.
But there is that in the book, and I suppose in your thought process, too, the sense of time passing and the river that we walk through is never the same twice and so forth. But there's also something else there, and that's a sense that the characters seem to get through by going out of their way, really, to help each other.
Well, I think Louise does. I think Louise leads the way. And I was consciously trying to create a character who was loving and nurturing and giving and who would be relentlessly so. She can be sharp-tongued, and she can be even nasty at times if she thinks that you're giving up on yourself. But basically what drives her is a tremendous sense of love and a tremendous feeling that as long as she can help people recover and help people find more life, that's what she's on earth to do. And it was great fun creating that character.
Was there somebody like that in your life?
There are people like that in everybody's life, at least everybody who's fortunate, whether it's a parent, you know, who just has the kind of love for a child that will never give up, or a grandparent, or sometimes a teacher or somebody that you learn a trade from or learn a sport from. It could be a coach, for that matter. Louise is a kind of combination of all of those people who don't give up on somebody and who maybe she certainly, in this case, Louise has an ulterior motive, as I said. You know, she's got her own agenda as well. But the great thing driving her, I think, is wanting to see life continue and grow and flourish and not being willing to accept the alternative.
you don't seem to be about endings.
Well, I hope there's a beginning at the end of the book. I hope that there is a tendency to look forward, and that's one of the things that Pete Esty discovers and takes away from his relationship with Louise Brown, is that you must look forward, and you must get up every day and do, and you must understand something about your place in the human community and take advantage of every breath you're blessed to take.
Some of the details escape us in terms of how other characters resolve their particular situations. And I think that left me feeling that, you know, I wish Bill would write a sequel.
Ah, well, if there was a guy, Elliot Aisonoff, one of my pals who wrote Eight Men Out, the story of the Black Sox scandal, he read this book and he wrote and he said, now we got to have the book about Jack Brown in the major leagues.
Yes!
That would be a much harder book to write because, you'd have to deal with so much of the nonsense and foolishness that encumber professional sports now. And I basically avoided that by only having Jack have a day in the majors.
You've written four books now.
Yeah, Prospect was the first one. Baseball Days is a collection of essays and photographs by Henry Horenstein, and that's came out in paper fairly recently from Pond Press. Keepers is a collection of radio pieces that Don Davidson did in Peninsula Press out in Cape Cod. He called me up and said, wouldn't you like to see these in a book? And I said, yeah, what's the catch? You know, why would anybody want to do that? But he did it, and that's a fun book to have in print. And then Champions is a book that I did for young readers on 10 remarkable athletes. And then in the fall, the fifth one is The Circus in the Woods. And that's a book for teenagers, but I hope it's a book that teenagers' parents like a lot too, and that they can sit down and talk about together. It's an attempt to talk a little bit about what it's like to grow up, and it's a novel. It takes place in Vermont, it was really fun because it's the first book since Prospect that I started writing with no idea at all whether anybody would ever be interested in it. And to have that one come to a finish has been very exciting.
May I ask if it's a sports story?
No, it has nothing to do with sports at all. It's a story. It's a woman looking back at a summer in her childhood. And some dramatic things happen. And she... goes through a series of adventures and moves towards growing up.
How did you come to Only a Game?
Well, I'd been doing commentaries here at BUR and for National Public Radio for about 9 years, and David Green was here and had done just about everything there was to do at WBUR at that point. And he and I started talking about the possibility of a sports program, and Jane Christo got involved in those discussions. And after a false start, we put together Only a Game pretty much as it presently is constituted. We began as a half-hour local show, then we went to an hour, then NPR got involved, and it became a national show. But it was in a significant way, it was an outgrowth of the work that I'd been doing here for about 9 years before the show.
Only a Game is different. It's hard to describe. What are you trying to do with the program that sets it apart so vividly?
Well, in a sense, it's different because I think most people who tell sports stories, whether they tell them on the radio or on television or through some other medium, employ a kind of shorthand which assumes that people are very familiar with the subject matter of the story. It doesn't take long to tell somebody who won a baseball game, how many hits each team got, how many hits the pitcher allowed, who got the game-winning hit. You can do that in sort of a shorthand way. Likewise with any other sport. I think what we try to do is what public radio tries to do, no matter what subject is being covered, And that is try to give a story time enough to breathe. Try to give everybody, you know, when you're out in the field and you get to talk to people, talk to the 85-year-old guy in the stands who's watched baseball for 70 years and looks at the shortstop and says, you know, I remember a kid who played just like that. And, of course, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, these kinds of stories. And find the scout in the stands whose grandson just made it to the major leagues and talk to both of them. You know, there's your story. I don't think most people who cover sports take the time to have that kind of fun, and that's what we're after.
More than the event, more than the numbers, it's the people.
Oh, very much so, yeah. So, I mean, I did a story earlier this year, a series of pieces on the Roxbury Community College basketball team, and nobody was, you know, nobody, even in Boston, nobody was paying attention. The gym was full for some of the games, and they might have 600 people for the big games. But even when they played in the national championship tournament, it was out in Delhi, New York, which most people couldn't find on a map. It was in a gym which probably seated a total of maybe 800 or 900 people, and it wasn't full. The people who were there were very enthusiastic, and we all had a great time watching these marvelous athletes play basketball. But there was none of the static and craziness created by marketing. It was just the game. They won the national championship, Division III Junior College National Championship, a year ago. But to me, the most remarkable statistic that came out of that story was not that I think that year they went 32-2 and won the national championship. But the most amazing statistic was that they had four seniors on that team. And by seniors, of course, with a junior college, they're sophomores, guys who complete 2 years of college. All four of them went on to four-year colleges and had done remarkably well.
You've done a series on the Roxbury team. Here's an excerpt from just one of your stories.
J.L., world baseball! Play some defense! It ain't no acting class!
On Sunday, March the 4th, at the Reggie Lewis Center in Boston, the Roxbury Community College men's basketball team played sufficient defense to take a 15-point lead into the locker room at halftime. The opponent that night, Springfield Technical Community College, had pushed Roxbury into overtime at the Division III Junior College State Championships the previous week. With the regional championship on the line, Roxbury coach Malcolm Wynn kept it simple in his instructions for the second half.
Right now, let's play the best 20 minutes of the year. These next 20 minutes are going to be our best 20 minutes of the year.
They may have been. Behind Kareem Horton's 31 points and tenacious team defense, Roxbury won the team's second consecutive regional championship, 98-71. That win brought Roxbury's record to 29-0 for the season. The following week, the Roxbury players convened for practice to prepare for this week's national championships. While they warmed up, Coach Wynn confided to me that the season had inspired in him a dream.
It seemed very realistic to be in a room full of coaches, and the question arises, how many people here won a national championship? And myself and a few other folks are going to raise their hand. Then they're going to say, how many people here did it twice? And myself and a few other people are going to raise their hand. Then they're going to say, well, how many people did it back to back? Me and maybe John Wooden is going to raise our hand. Then they're going to say, well, who did it undefeated? Then me and John's going to get up, leave the room, and have a good conversation about basketball.
For Roxbury, it's been the kind of season where dreams like that have been inevitable. Blinded by the hype that accompanies the televised product of Division I basketball, most folks may not have noticed what's been going on at the Division III junior college or JUCO level. But Jamil Abdullah, second-year center-slash-forward for Roxbury, an aspiring engineer, says nobody should underestimate the significance of the tournament in which Roxbury is presently involved.
Just like a lot of people say, you know, that's only a D3 JUCO. This is big for me. And another guy in like a Division I school would say, that's nothing. You know what I mean? But this is like I'm the king of my castle, regardless of if it's a little shack. You may be the king of the castle on the hill, but I'm the king of this right here. Can't nobody take that away. You know what I mean? You come to my home, it's like wipe your feet. You know what I'm saying? So it's real exciting for me.
The guys who really interest me in this story are the guys whose basketball careers now are over, but who have demonstrated to themselves and others that they can cut it academically, which they may not ever have thought they could do, and who are going to go on and become engineers and going to become architects and going to become, you know, go into other professions that might have been completely fantasy, out of reach entirely before they buckle down to academics at the community college level.
So this combines, in a sense, the idea of teaching, of educating, of bringing people into those worlds, along with your basic love of sport, which you seem to have been born with.
Yeah, this has been a wonderful story for me. I mean, it's been great. It's been great fun to discover a world that I was, you know, I didn't know a whole lot about junior colleges, and I didn't know a lot about the kind of athletes and students who end up at junior colleges and then discover direction beyond them. So this was great fun.
And there's often an element of whimsy in the stories you do on Only a Game, such as your recent report on the great game of Quidditch. Yes, Quidditch. Here's an excerpt.
All right, there's four in there.
So I should pick two?
Pick two. Those will be the two teams that play on the pitch. It's called pitch.
It starts, as it must, with a sorting hat. In J.K. Rowling's remarkable Harry Potter novels, the Sorting Hat decides which of the four houses at the Hogwarts School will claim each new student of wizardry. At the Choxit Middle School in Stirling, Massachusetts, the Sorting Hat determines the teams for a game of Quidditch, played at 11:30 on a recent weekday afternoon. Since the Choxit Sorting Hat, unlike the one at Hogwarts, isn't alive, it requires a non-magical or muggle assistant. In this case, me. Physical education teacher Susan Lauder holds the hat, and I make the picks.
We got the greens.
Oh, they'll love that, yeah. That's the enemy.
And the reds.
How'd you do? Are you tall? It's because you're tall.
I can't see. I could not see in the sorting hat, I promise. It's all on the up and up.
Well, boys and girls, who's green? Who are they?
Slytherin.
Green Slytherin. Who's red?
Gryffindor.
He picked the classic.
Harry's house, Gryffindor, against arch-rival Slytherin, where dwell Draco Malfoy and the nefarious Professor Snape. What a matchup.
Here goes the puck.
In case there's anybody on the planet who hasn't read at least one of the Harry Potter novels, the game of Quidditch, at which Harry excels, finds players flying around on broomsticks and features, among other things, a mischievous sphere called the Snitch, which swoops and zooms about the sky until a player called a Seeker captures it to end the game.
Yes.
Other players attempt to score by maneuvering a ball called a Quaffle through a hoop, meanwhile dodging flying bludgers, which, if undodged, can knock them off their broomsticks and send them plummeting to Earth. Obviously, the first thing Susan Lauder had to figure out when she was inventing Muggle Quidditch, or Quidditch for the Earthbound, was how to play the game within the rules established by gravity.
Right, and, you know, as funny as it is, when the kids would ask me about Quidditch, that's the first thing they would say is, how will we fly? And I would kiddingly say, I've ordered brooms, they're coming in.
In your writing, there's almost a lyrical approach to sport, and obviously you're classically trained at Yale and at Harvard. And did this come with you all your life? You seem to find a beauty in competition, a beauty in the limits of these games. I'm just curious as to where that came from.
I wouldn't say it was as a result of any specific training. I think, you know, what I do and what I write, it's what I see and what I feel. And baseball is a wonderful sport for watching at great length and for thinking about and for, you know, you don't want to get too serious about, you know, equating baseball with life or anything like that. I think that's largely hokum. But there are certainly things that you can see in baseball that are slow and that are lyrical and that are beautiful. And, you know, it's probably as true of other games if you grow up in another culture or you grow up in a different family. I'm sure, that, for example, that there are people whose fathers or mothers take them to a golf course early on, and they look and they say, my gosh, the grass is so green and it's all so beautiful. People visiting the Masters course in Augusta must feel that way when they see it for the first time.
Was there ever a time when you were not writing?
Yeah, I'm sure there was, but I'd have to go back a long way. It was certainly something that I did at college. Nothing that I wrote was worth much, but I was writing. And I remember even back in junior high school, I remember junior high school magazine coming out with a piece that I wrote in it. And my thinking, you know, this was pretty cool to have done that. And I remember thinking when I was a kid, 14, 15 years old, wouldn't it be a great thing someday to have in my hand a book that I had written and to be able to say I wrote this and hand it to somebody and say, you might give this a read. I remember feeling, even as a kid, that that would be a pretty terrific thing to be able to do. When I first moved up here to Boston, I was playing on a not very good softball team in Brookline, and the editor of the local paper came over and he asked if somebody would write a piece about the softball league that we played in, kind of just a human interest piece for the local paper. And I said, sure, I'd do that. And he liked it. And what grew out of that was a sports column for the Boston Ledger. And if somebody had come up to me and said, I really need somebody to do movie reviews, maybe I'd be a movie reviewer today. But I got reinforced for doing the sports. And, writing about sports has certainly not come out of any triumphant athletic achievements on my part. There's much more writing than that.
Let's talk a bit about your teaching career. What was it that drew you to teaching and has kept you in it with all these other things going?
Well, I think the thing that drew me to it was a couple of things. One was I remember feeling when I was still in school that I never wanted to be at a point where I was not reading stuff that I really loved, whether it was Shakespeare or Dostoevsky or Robert Penn Warren or whatever it might be. And I was afraid that if I went into some profession that didn't require me to read it, that I'd be lazy enough so that I would stop reading that stuff. So I thought teaching would be good. And then when I was between my sophomore and junior years in college, I taught at the Lawrenceville Summer School down in Lawrenceville, New Jersey, and had the incredible good fortune to work with a guy named Jim Waugh, who was a wonderful teacher and who showed me. I was his teaching assistant that summer. And he showed me how extraordinarily creative and energetic a teacher could be teaching literature. And once I'd seen him work, I thought, boy, that would be a great life. And he was very much responsible for my decision to pursue that.
And you're teaching what kinds of literature courses and writing courses, but specifically?
The English department at Curry is fairly small, so I teach whatever it's my turn to teach. And so it might be Shakespeare one semester and freshman composition the next, and American novel the semester after that, and writing about sports the next semester. But I'm only just teaching the one course each semester now because this is a pretty full-time commitment in here at WBUR.
When you teach writing, is it limited to sports writing?
No. I think writing is writing, and it's odd to bring this up, but boy, the longer I do it, the less sure I am of how you do it. And all I can do is, look at what kids write and say, here's what happens to me when I read it. You know, you lose me here in the third paragraph because something happened to the storytelling or the tense or whatever it might be. Or, boy, you really get me here with this detail at the top of the page. All of a sudden, I really find myself paying attention. Let's see if you can do some more of that. That kind of response to something.
Talk about the relationship of a lot of the American people to sports. They do seem to take them very seriously and identify with teams or with individuals in a way that I suppose other countries do. But, of course, this is the one we live in. What is it that ties Americans to the identity of their sports heroes?
I don't know exactly what it is. I mean, the answer that I always got when I would ask people who've been doing this longer and more wisely than I was, well, the attraction of a sports hero is he or she can do something that the rest of us can't do, whether it's hit a 95-mile-an-hour fastball or serve a tennis ball at 100 miles an hour or, cut left and then right and then take a puck on the stick and shoot it into the upper left corner of the goal or whatever it might be.
And I think that's probably part of it. It's become a muddier issue over the last couple decades, certainly, because sports at the highest level is marketed so ferociously now that it's a bit hard to separate the real innocent kind of attraction and passion that we associate sometimes with sports with the manufactured corporate kind of attraction that so many companies and so many sponsors and so much televised sports has developed. So it's maybe not as easy to answer that question as it once would have been.
Bill, you've spoken somewhat about what you see as the role of sports in society, and it seems to me that you go to it for relief from some of the bigger things that go on in life and some of the bigger issues that people face and that most people do. Is that accurate? Is my perception accurate?
Well, I think that people lose sight now of the fact that games are supposed to be diversions. They are supposed to be a relief. They are supposed to be something that you relax into and enjoy, and you use the games to take your mind off things that, you know, that might be troubling and over which you might have no control. The problem, I think, with our current landscape of sports is that the sports themselves and the athletes who play them are marketed so ferociously and so relentlessly, and they're so much a creation of that marketing effort. So often when you see a player, a baseball player, a football, basketball player, whatever it might be on TV, he's a persona. He's somebody who's been trained as an actor, and it's hard to kind of find that the purity, the kind of clean lines of sports that maybe attracted you to that sport to begin with. And that's kind of too bad, but it's not unavailable. You know, the minor league guys are not pushing anything on TV. The guys playing in the park league are not selling anything yet. Their images are not for sale.
What role do you think the sports writers and the commentators, television, radio, and so on, ought to be playing in terms of the reportage on sports and the way that it's handled now?
I'm not sure what role they ought to be playing. I'm afraid that now, as I said before, sports is so much a business and so much a matter of marketing that nobody who doesn't go along with that format is ever going to get a job in sports. It's hard to imagine, for example, some of the old-time baseball announcers ever getting work now. They were storytellers. You know, some of these guys, I mean, when I first moved to Boston, Ned Martin and Jim Woods were doing the Red Sox games. I looked forward to rain delays because their stories were so good. Sometimes the Red Sox teams of those years were not so good, but the announcers were terrific and the stories were wonderful. But it's hard to imagine somebody like that getting employment now. You know, they didn't look good when the TV camera was on them. They kind of wandered off into stories. They were critical of the home team when they didn't play well. They were not into marketing the way that it seems to be necessary to be these days.
Did you play at the college level?
Intramurals. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I played intramural everything. My senior year in college, I announced that I would be available for all possible intramural sports. So I not only played softball, basketball, squash, hockey, I also bowled. I bowled for the Saybrook bowling team. I bowled against John Hersey.
Oh, my.
I can't remember who won.
Another writer.
Yes, a somewhat more accomplished one might point out.
Well, you'll get a debate after reading Prospect.
Well, thank you. That's very kind.
But you've played all your life. You've played one sport or another.
I grew up in New Jersey, and I grew up in a culture where not only at home but in prep school and college where that was what boys and young men did. And I played everything there was to play, and I wasn't worth much at any of it, but I was good enough to play and certainly good enough to enjoy it. And my parents were very tolerant and you know, did all the carpooling and so that I could play in all the leagues mm-hmm. and everything growing up, baseball and basketball and hockey and all that. But, hey, you know, it was great fun, but I don't think that you can't look back at any athletic achievement for any of the roots of this.
Let me ask you where the passion for soccer came from. It's the one sport you didn't mention playing growing up.
Well, I didn't play it much growing up. I played a little bit in school when I didn't make the tennis team, and there were no more slots on the tennis court, so they said, you're a soccer player, and I wasn't very good at it. But the passion came really from a fellow named Dick Johnson, who runs the New England Sports Museum, is a curator there. He called me up in 1991, and he said, you got to go over to the Charles Hotel in Cambridge because the women's national team is staying there, and they're going to play two games against the Norwegian national soccer team, one at Tufts, and you got to come out and see this game, and you got to meet these players because they're terrific. And I thought, well, okay, I mean, as a favor to Dick, I'll do that. And boy, was he right. And the coach, Anson Dorrance, was wonderful. The players were great. The game was magnificent. And that was the beginning, 10 years ago, of this incredible wave of appreciation and success that the women's soccer team has generated, culminating, of course, with the 99 World Cup here, and, of course, the WUSA, the pro league that begins this year. And I just got very excited by that. And then my kids play, and I got involved in the coaching. And then as a result of one of the WBUR Citizens of the World tours, I got to go over to Spain and see FC Barcelona play, where there were only 120,000 people watching that game. So let's see, that's about four times the size of Fenway Park.
That's right.
And that was a magnificent experience. So all of these things combined to be a middle-aged guy discovering a sport that I'd never paid much attention to 10 years ago, discovering that. It was great fun, great feeling. And I felt like I could bring a kind of real brand new enthusiasm to it. And the only problem now is that everybody at Only a Game is sick of hearing about sports and they kind of boo and hiss every time I say, hey, I got a good soccer story. And then they drown me out with football, baseball, and basketball.
Regular listeners to Only a Game and your others are aware that you have two daughters, that you coach soccer with them. Family seems to be central to your life.
It is, absolutely. And not just because my daughters play soccer. My wife often says that, what would you do with your daughters if they stopped playing soccer? That's why it's so important to you. I like to coach them, but my daughters are great and my wife is marvelous. And that's obviously the most important thing.
Well, you might take them bowling, as you did in one of your articles. And we have that on tape from the reading the other night. So let's listen to Bill Littlefield as a written description of the time that he went bowling with his family.
I had remembered bowling as a very forgiving game in which people don't get hurt and nothing much can go wrong. So on a recent wet weekend afternoon, it seemed like a good idea to take the family out to the Candlepin Lanes. Once there, things began to go wrong right away. In her very first frame, Allison, my younger daughter, who is 5, knocked down 2 pins. They fell slowly, reluctantly, but they fell. This would have been fine except that Amy, my older daughter, who is 8, bowled 3 gutter balls in her first frame and concluded that bowling was stupid. By the third frame, I was ready to agree with her. That was when the younger daughter threw 2 balls that never got going fast enough to make it to the end of the gutter. Each rolled for a while and then came gently to a stop as if it had gotten tired or run out of fuel. I had never seen this happen before, but I understood pretty much right away that I had 2 options. I could walk self-consciously down the alley, pick up the balls, and bring them back to the ball rack, or I could wind up and wing a ball down the gutter hard enough to knock the inert balls past the pins. I chose to do the former, though I felt like a fool. With each step, I expected to hear the owner of the alley shout, "Hey, you blockhead, what are you doing down there by the pins?" But he didn't, and nobody laughed. When it was Allison's turn to bowl again, I told her to try to roll the ball a little bit harder, and for a frame or two, she did, and though she didn't knock down any pins, all the balls made it to the end of the alley. This seemed to please her, and it certainly pleased me. Meanwhile, my wife, "The point is to have fun," she said. "Don't look so grim about it." Maybe I was looking grim because of a premonition of what would happen next. Returning from her 7th or 8th trip to the drinking fountain, Allison nudged a couple more balls about 3/4 of the way down the right-hand gutter where they quietly came to rest. This time, I decided to knock them the rest of the way home. I wound up, probably looking very grim, and fired a ball directly down the gutter. It was, unfortunately, careening side to side within the gutter when it hit the closer stalled ball, and although both of Allison's balls rolled obediently into the pit behind the pins, my shot bounced completely over our alley and crashed into the pins on the adjacent lane. That probably surprised the man who was bowling there, although I'm not sure of that because I couldn't meet his eyes. "Do those pins count on your score?" Amy shouted. "Absolutely," I said. "No fair," she said, and my wife told me again that I shouldn't throw the ball so hard. By the time we'd reached the final frames, Allison was slithering like a snake around the molded plastic seat, and Amy had begun walking away from each shot without waiting to see where the ball went. But weirdly, when the game was over, they both wanted to bowl another string. "No," I told him, "it's time to go. Maybe we'll come back another day. And maybe if I can ever forget almost everything that happened that day, we will."
That sums up not only a family relationship that is obviously quite deep and warm, but a father that knows how it is to work with a couple of rambunctious kids.
Yes, and a father too stupid at the time to understand that there are bowling alleys where they put those bumpers down the gutters, and so it's actually impossible to roll the ball and not knock down some pins. And I've since learned that those glorious places exist.
Time. How do you manage your time?
Well, with a certain amount of despair hovering over my shoulder at all times. It's very difficult, and one of the things that I've found helps is to kind of try and break it up into chunks. The Circus in the Woods, I wrote basically over several years by working between 5 a.m. and 6:15 a.m. when the first person in the house comes downstairs. that's when the time was available. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of, you know, steal the time when you can, I don't know.
Well, is there anything you'd like to add, Bill Littlefield, before we bid farewell to author, teacher, writer, and host of Only a Game?
Well, I just thank you very much, Ted, for allowing me to visit and talk about my book and some of these other things. You're making me feel tired because you've reminded me of how many things I'm doing. I think I better go home and take a nap.
All right. And wake up in time for Only a Game, which is heard at 2 o'clock and 7 a.m. on Saturdays. You've been listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. Tonight, a conversation with Bill Littlefield of NPR's Only a Game and author of Prospect, recently published in paperback by Houghton Mifflin. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15, including...